Well, although we opened Nahum chapter 2 last time, we didn't get entirely through the first verse. So I want to revisit it. And it said, Nahum 2:1, "Look, on the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, proclaiming shalom. Keep your festivals, Judah. Fulfill your vows. For Belial will never pass through you again. He has been completely destroyed." Now, most Christians who have some good Bible knowledge and read this want to rightly associate this with Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah 14, starting at verse 1, "Look, a day is coming for Yahweh when your plundered Jerusalem will be divided right there within you. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem for war. The city will be taken, the houses will be rifled, the women will be raped, and half the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. Then Yahweh will go out and fight against those nations, fighting as on a day of battle. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which lies to the east of Jerusalem. The Mount of Olives will be split in half from east to west to make a huge valley, and half of the mountain will move towards the north, half of it towards the south." So here in Zechariah, we see God setting his feet on the mountains of Jerusalem in the end times. However, we have to be cautious and nuanced as to how we connect that to Nahum 2:1. Now, to review what I told you last week, from a biblical standpoint, we have to be careful to not organically attach the two English words, deliverance and salvation. Although Christian scholars have a bad tendency to flip back and forth between the two words, deliverance and salvation, making them synonymous. In reality, that's not the case. Most often, the Hebrew word that means to rescue or deliver from trouble is yeshah. But the Hebrew word for salvation in a spiritual sense is Yahshua or Yeshua. Sometimes the word could actually be Teshua, which seems to combine some elements of both of these meanings. Therefore, when we read books in the Tanakh that seem to speak about salvation in the form of Yeshua the Messiah, that's only the case if the word Yahshua is used. When we read Yasha, it more heavily means deliverance from oppression, from a physical enemy. None of those terms for deliverance or salvation are used in this Nahum passage. It's only implied. And now that we have the ability to look into the rear view mirrors of history, we can see how Nahum 1, about the feet of him who brings good news, will apply differently depending on the era we're dealing with. In Nahum's era, and for the next few centuries, this is not the Yahshua spiritual kind of salvation. Rather, it's the Yasha, the deliverance from an enemy military force. Thus, as Nahum and the Israelites in general would have taken it, it means that the feet on the mountain bringing good news is a human sentinel, a messenger sent from an Israelite army general to tell the people of Jerusalem that they've been victorious. Thus, they are delivered from that invading military force. Only a long time later does it apply as Yahshua, the spiritual salvation of Israel. So let's reread chapter 2, and then we will continue with the second half of verse 1. So Nahum chapter 2. Look, on the mountain are the feet of him who brings good news, proclaiming shalom. Keep your festivals, Judah. Fulfill your vows, for Belial will never pass through you again. He has been completely destroyed. A destroyer has risen in front of your face. Guard the ramparts. Keep watch the road. Brace yourselves. Marshal all your strength. For Adonai is restoring the pride of Yaakov, along with the pride of Israel. Because plunderers have plundered them and ravaged their vines. The shields of Nineveh's warriors are dyed red. The soldiers are wearing scarlet. The steel of the chariots flashes like fire as they prepare for battle. The cypress spears are poisoned. The chariots rush madly about in the streets, jostling each other in the open places. Their appearance is like torches. They run here, there, like lightning. The king of Nineveh assigns his officers. They stumble as they march. They hurry to its wall and set up shields to protect the battering ram. The gates of the rivers are opened, and the palace melts away. Its mistress is stripped and carried away. Her handmaids moan. They sound like doves as they beat their breasts. Nineveh is like a pool whose water ebbs away. Stop, stop, but none of it goes back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. There is no end to the treasure, weighed down with precious things. She is void, vacant, she's made bare. Hearts are melting, knees are knocking, every stomach is churning, every face drained of color. What has become of the lion's den, the cave where the young lions fed, where lion and lioness walked with their cubs, and no one made them afraid? The lion would tear up food for his cubs and strangle prey for his lionesses. He used to fill his caves with prey, his lairs with torn flesh. I'm against you, says Adonai Sevaot. Her chariots I will send up in smoke. The sword will consume your lion cubs. I will destroy your prey from the earth, and your envoys' voices will be heard no more. The key message of the second part of verse 1 is that Israel can resume its biblically mandated festivals. Clearly, Assyria had shut them down or greatly impeded them, and then later on, Babylon did as well. Now, since this message is specifically to Judah, the southern Israelite kingdom of Judah, then this must be speaking of deliverance from an attempted invasion of Judah by Assyria that God intervened in and killed 185,000 Assyrian soldiers, thus not ever allowing Assyria to fully control Judah and Jerusalem. Now be aware that this is speaking of a time many decades after Assyria successfully invaded the northern Israelite kingdom of Ephraim Israel and sent its residents into exile. Now notice that the summons of the Lord for Judah to now begin keeping their festivals, their appointed times, is to also complete their vows. That is, when completing a vow, it was necessary to perform a specific ritual along with the sacrifice. And the only place that could happen was at the Jerusalem temple. Now, I want to draw attention that despite the false church teaching that Yeshua had ended the sacrificial system, Paul certainly did not think so. Nor did he teach such a thing. Listen to Acts 21, 18 to 24. The next day, Shaul and the rest of us went to Yaakov, and all the elders were present. And after greeting them, Shaul described in detail each of the things God had done among the Gentiles through his efforts. Now, on hearing it, they praised God, but they also said to him, "You see, brother, how many tens of thousands of believers there are among the Judeans, and they're all zealous for the Torah. Now, what they have been told about you is that you are teaching all the Jews living among the Goyim, among the Gentiles, to apostatize from Moses, telling them not to have a Brit Milah, a circumcision ceremony, for their sons, not to follow the traditions. What then's to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. So do what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take them with you, be purified with them, and pay the expenses connected with having their heads shaved. Then everyone will know that there is nothing to these rumors which they've heard about you, but that on the contrary, you yourself stay in line and keep the Torah. Okay, again, the word Belial pops up to end this first verse. This stanza of the Hebrew poem begins with ki. In English, it's the word for. We've already discussed how ki works in Hebrew poetry. Here, it introduces the meaning of and explains the great change that is coming for Judah. Essentially, Assyria is Belial. And Belial is used as a personification of evil. So once God has finished his business with Assyria, Assyria is finished existing as an empire. Therefore, God promises Judah that Assyria will never again be their oppressors because their existence is going to be terminated once and for all. Let me be clear, though. This in no way means that the former Assyrian Empire won't again be reconstituted under a different nation with a different and non-Assyrian king at its head. And, essentially, Babylon took Assyria's empire away from Assyria. And in later centuries, several independent nations have sprung up where the Assyrian Empire used to exist. Nations come and go. Old ones cease to exist, new ones arise in their absence, and most often with different national boundaries. Nahum 2:2. A destroyer has arisen in front of your face. Guard the ramparts, keep watch on the road, brace yourselves, and marshal all your strength. Now the YLT Bible version puts this verse in a better way. Come up, hath a scatterer to thy face. Keep the bulwark, watch the way, strengthen the loins, strengthen power mightily. Notice first how the Young's Literal Translation calls this verse verse 1, whereas the Complete Jewish Bible calls it verse 2. It is just a choice of the translator which chapter to put this into, but it doesn't harm the context or meaning either way. What has happened is that from speaking to Judah, the oracle switches back to speaking to Assyria. And the Hebrew word to begin this word is mephes, which means scatterer, not destroyer. It is meant to describe Yehovah's effect on his army. However, only in the extended spiritual sense is this scatterer that is going to confront Assyria Yehovah. Rather, this scatterer must be Babylon and its ally media. This is because God is going to use the Babylon media alliance to exert his wrath upon Assyria. Babylon then will do to Assyria what they did to Ephraim Israel to conquer and then scatter them. Now, in God's warning to Assyria of what's coming, the tone is not far from sarcasm. So what we read is closer to satire. When he tells Assyria to keep or to guard the bulwark and to watch the way and to strengthen the loins, to strengthen their power, it is to give the king of Assyria advice, knowing he's not going to follow it until it's too late. There's a lively debate over precisely how to translate each of these words in this poetic satire towards Assyria, but pretty much any of the various Bible versions do it well enough to make the point. There's no reason for scholarly debates on such matters because we are dealing with Hebrew poetry anyway. And the precise meaning, and therefore how to find the perfect English word to translate the Hebrew words for each of these actions, was chosen less by Nahum for its accurate depiction, more for its usefulness in the poetic structure, for the purpose of line length, the number of words and letters, the total numeric value of those words, and other such nuances. That said, I will point out one of God's warnings, because it helps us to understand a rather common Hebrew phrase that's used in both the Old and New Testaments. That phrase is, gird up or strengthen your loins. Okay. It was believed in ancient times that the source of a man's strength and vitality was literally in his loins. Just as the source of various kinds of human emotional or intellectual attributes were believed to be centered in various of our organs. So to gird up and strengthen loins was just a way of saying, make yourself strong, physically and mentally, to prepare for combat. Now, no doubt this warning seemed absurd to King Sennacherib. Nineveh was a fortress with an army second to none. The armory grounds of Nineveh alone were over 40 acres, bigger than most walled cities in that era. They had more chariots, horses, bows, spears than any nation on earth. But for God, none of that matters. Once he's determined your fate, good or bad, it's set in stone. Nahum 2:3. For Yehovah is restoring the pride of Yaakov, along with the pride of Israel, because plunderers have plundered them and ravaged their vines. Again, the first word of this stanza is key. Here it's causal, that is, because of what God has pronounced, then what follows is going to happen. What was perhaps the greatest city on earth, a wonder of the world at that time, Nineveh was going to be destroyed. And the glory of that place would now be set aside and given over to Israel. A reversal of fortune that was impossible to even imagine under the circumstances, just as Egypt had to be destroyed in order for Israel to be redeemed, so Assyria had to be ruined for Israel to be restored. This is such an important God principle. God's justice demands that those who harm his people will themselves be harmed. And what we find is that the punishment usually follows closely along the lines of how the enemy harmed Israel. Not only is this an issue of God's nature as it concerns justice, but as it concerns Israel, it is to fulfill the promise God made to Abraham so long ago. Genesis 12:1. Now Yehovah said to Avram, get yourself out of your country, away from your kinsmen, away from your father's house. Go to the land I'll show you. I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you are to be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, but I will curse anyone who curses you. And by you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So for God, his favor upon them amounts far less to the actual righteousness of Israel at any point in history than to the righteousness of the patriarchs, that God will watch over Israel and care for them. Here in Nahum, the overriding reason for his determination to exterminate Assyria remains the same. Thus, it isn't surprising that these words from Nahum invokes the name of a patriarch when speaking about God restoring Israel's pride. This stanza literally says Jacob, Yaakov. It's interesting that the Hebrew word that is being translated here as restoring is sab. Sab is a form of the root word sub. Sub means to return. Thus, there is a connection in Hebrew vocabulary between the concepts of restoration and returning. And again, employing the patriarch Jacob's name is important to understanding why this word was chosen. But in actual practice, Jacob's pride represents the land that Israel was given to them by God. So this is by no means speaking of the return of exiles, but rather a recovery of the land itself. The next stanza that is along with the pride of Israel, it serves to make a play on words. Once again, the YLT version can help us to see the connections and the better sense of what's being said in Nahum 2:2, which matches up with Complete Jewish Bible 2:3. For turned back hath Jehovah to the excellency of Jacob as to the excellency of Israel, for emptied them out have emptiers, and their branches they have marred. By using the word Israel, the meaning now expands to mean all Israel, both kingdoms, the northern and the southern. Up to now, the prophecy primarily addressed only Judah. The word that some Bibles translate as destroyers, others as scatterers, is bokach. And it means to scatter, not to destroy, which indeed might be a result of scattering, but it's not the scattering itself. So whether we go with the YLT's emptiers or the more literal scatterers, the result's the same. The land is emptied by means of scattering the people. But who exactly are the emptiers? Who did it? Because that then determines whose branches have been marred, as the final half of verse 2 speaks of. Well, there's two scholarly points of view. First, they are Assyria. Second, they are Babylon, who scattered the former scatterers, Assyria. Israel and Judah are regularly called the vine in the Bible. Yet here, I don't think anyone is being called a name like the vine, but rather it is descriptive of vineyards that were ravaged and destroyed. In the end, for me, since the references to Israel as the vine are so predominant in the entire Bible, I conclude that the vineyards are Israel's vineyards. And so, the scattered was Israel. Put it another way, the scatterers was Assyria. The ravaged vines are Israel's vineyards, which doubles as meaning the Israelites themselves. Now, Nahum 2:4. The shields of Nineveh's warriors are dyed red. The soldiers are wearing scarlet. The steel of the chariots flashes like fire as they prepare for battle. The cypress spears are poisoned. First of all, I have yet to find even two Bible versions that word this verse the same. There are a few reasons for this, including, once again, grammar that does not work correctly as one might expect in normal prose or in Western-style poetry. But as we've discussed numerous times, Nahum is not normal prose. It is Hebrew poetry from his era of history. Now, once we set that issue aside, then instead of trying to find an answer that in the end doesn't even match the surrounding context of the Nahum prophecy, we can bypass that problem and not see it as a problem at all and see this stanza better for what it's trying to tell us. Here in verse 4, it is the swift advance of the enemy forces that are coming to invade Assyria and its capital city, Nineveh. So this is military-oriented in its nature. Yet this battle has a cosmic element to it. That is, it also blends into the earthly happenings, matters of the spirit world. See, we begin with removing the word Nineveh that the complete Jewish Bible has added in. Nineveh does not appear here. Only the translator thinks that it's Nineveh's soldiers that are being spoken about. That's incorrect. These are Babylon's and the Medes' soldiers. The shields are just as we would think of them. They are for defending against their enemies' arrows and swords. Now, these shields are red does not mean that they're soaked in the blood of their enemy. Rather, it's either they have been painted red, or more likely, they're made from copper. Copper that's polished has a definite reddish color to it. And when we encounter what is often translated as warrior, to mean the soldiers that are carrying the shields, the Hebrew is gibberehu, gibberehu. See, it's a form of the Hebrew gibor, which more means mighty men, heroes, a warrior leader, something like that. See, not every soldier had a metal shield. The common foot soldier had a shield made from matted reeds, covered with an animal hide, or something similar. It was the special warriors, their leaders, who had the privilege of having metal shields, as they were far more effective. Here's the thing. This term gibor or gibore is in rare occasions in the Bible used for the mighty ones in heaven, the angel warriors. Psalm 103 is a great example of this. Psalm 103:20, bless Yehovah, you angels of his, you mighty warriors who obey his word, who carry out his orders. The second time that warriors are referred to in this verse from Nahum is where we read the soldiers are wearing scarlet. An entirely different Hebrew word is used here, anse halil, which is often translated as men of valor, but I think that misses the point. These are the regular common soldiers. And in heaven, these are the warrior angels that follow the chief warrior angels, the gibborei. In other words, we have here a typically described army consisting of its leaders, who are the best and mightiest of them, as well as the vast number of them who are the common soldiers. And this applies to whether we're speaking of earthly or heavenly armies. Now, these common soldiers are said to be dressed in scarlet. However, there is little agreement among scholars as to a correct translation of the Hebrew matulaim. This word does seem to speak of dyed cloth, but whether it means to speak of the color scarlet, that's a whole other matter. It is interesting that in Ezekiel 23, we find reference to the Assyrian soldiers wearing purple clothing, also to the Babylonians depicted in a similar fashion. So whatever color is meant here, it is eye-catching. And it must be an impressive sight on a battlefield. Some researchers think that the use of a red color is meant to look like blood. Others opine that in a fierce, muddled, close-quarter masses of hand-to-hand combatants, the red of their garments made it easier to distinguish friend from foe. Well, next we read of the steel of the chariots flashing like fire. The YLT probably resolves this the best by retaining a word for a word-for-word literal translation that is, with fiery torches is the chariot and a day of his preparation. Now, whether the word steel appears in the verse depends on whether the translator is drawing from the Masoretic Hebrew text or the Greek Septuagint. Okay. The Hebrew is Ba'ish Peledot, which literally means the metal flashes. The assumption that it was steel and not just iron is unwarranted. It certainly was metal of some sort that was shiny enough that when the chariots were on full charge, the ambient daylight, a daytime light, would make them have the appearance of torches of fire. Now, although once again I remind us, this is poetry, not just a straightforward historical account that we're reading. So some amount of hyperbole and embellishment is just par for the course. Even so, there were only certain areas on a chariot where we might even find metal. Generally speaking, chariots were quite lightweight. Two-wheeled carts pulled by a pair of horses. Usually a minimum of two, often three soldiers stood on it. One to drive, the other one or two to use their weapons. They were the tanks of their era. They were most effective and terrifying. But the weight of a chariot was critical. So the heaviness of metal had to be used only for things like axle hubs. And very probably, the crudely made hubs that made contact with the metal wheel inserts where they mounted to the chariot axle probably threw off sparks as they dashed into battle. Now, the final part of this verse, which is that the Cypress spears are poisoned, according to the Complete Jewish Bible, is quite off the mark. The word poisoned is not present, not even appropriate. Further, the word spears is not present. That these are likely spears is true. Now, what we're being told is that whatever these weapons are, they're made of cypress wood, which I can only assume was common in that day. Now, without doubt, this poetic description is meant to invoke awesome image of the heavenly hosts of Yahweh going into battle, even though the prophet also knows that this coming battle will be among human soldiers. But such was the mind of the Hebrews of that era that most predicted things occurred within a reality of duality. It happens on earth and in heaven, more or less in parallel. The descriptions we are reading are meant to depict these cosmic chariots of fire coming with the unstoppable force of a storm. along with the terrifying shaking of an earthquake, things which traditionally accompany a theophany of God appearing. Nahum 2:5. The chariots rush madly about in the streets, jostling each other in the open places. Their appearance is like torches. They run here, there, like lightning. Okay, here we have the invasion of Nineveh happening. What is pictured is the frantic and panicked reaction of the Assyrian military inside the city. They discounted what God said was going to happen, believing in their own invincibility. Now, suddenly, the enemy is already at their gates and in enormous numbers. The RSV Bible version adds some helpful nuances to the meaning of the Hebrew words used. The chariots rage in the streets. They rush to and fro through the squares. They gleam like torches. They dart like lightning. Now, this again is what's happening inside the city. It is not that the Babylonians have already breached the walls, but rather that the Assyrians are rushing to their walls, gates, and vulnerable places to shore up their defenses. So we have the chariots racing through the city streets, also to and through the various city squares, no doubt to assemble in open places. Now, interestingly, some of the reason we see variation in translation for this verse has to do with a belief among translators that ancient city streets could in no way accommodate chariots. And it seems that at one time, the enormous city of Nineveh did indeed have far too narrow of streets for chariots to navigate. However, King Sennacherib changed that. Assyrian records about Sennacherib say this: I, Sennacherib, widened the squares, made bright the avenues and streets. I made its market streets wide enough to run a royal road. So Nahum paints an accurate, a completely plausible description of the military moving about rapidly as the invaders approached. Once again, the poetic and cosmic descriptive words of what the chariots looked like as they dashed around combined the earthly chaos with the heavenly. It's the reality of duality. But the Assyrians needed a miracle, which of course never came. The outcome was certain from the moment Nahum uttered his words. Now, I want to repeat something that I've said for each biblical prophet that we've studied. It is that the prophetic future has already been worked out and determined in heaven. And it is in a certain way already begun there. However, it is only when Yahweh gives that prophecy to a human prophet to pronounce to Israel that on earth the process of fulfillment begins. It is at that moment that prophecy gets transferred from heaven to earth. It's like a huge boulder that sits atop a hill, a tall hill, with a town down below in the valley that gets its first push. Once it's pushed, nothing can stop that boulder from wreaking its havoc. The prophetic words first spoken by the prophet are what pushes that boulder of fulfillment. From that point forward, the rest is just process that will be carried out over time until its inalterable climax. Nahum 2:6. The king of Nineveh assigns his officers. They stumble as they march. They hurry to its wall. They set up shields to protect the battering ram. Now, although it is awkward sounding, the YLT Bible version reinserts words that many English versions, such as the Complete Jewish Bible, just leave out. In the YLT, we read, "He doth remember his honorable ones. They stumble in their goings. They hasten to its walls, and prepared is the covering." Okay. Now, I want to put this in modern English form, but keeping those words that are originally there. It is, "His powerful ones are brought to remembrance." I'm rather confident of this because the great 19th century Bible scholar Keel says this verse means he remembers his glorious ones. Now, although the Complete Jewish Bible inserts the words "the king of Nineveh," which are not there, this gloss is true. The "he," to begin this verse, is referring to the king of Assyria. Now, interestingly, probably half of Bible scholars believe this scene is not of the king of Assyria and his top soldiers, but of the attacking Babylonian forces. Why? Because they get lost in trying to correct grammar, trying to repair what they see as corrupted text, once again ignoring or just not aware of the workings of Hebrew poetry. Once the words can be accepted as they are and the poetic structure is recognized, well, then sense can be made of it. The first Hebrew word is itzkor, and it means "he remembers." Next is ardiyahu, that means "powerful ones." This means the king of Assyria remembers, or better, calls to mind, and calls upon and depends on his generals and his top warriors, not just his common foot soldiers, to save the day. Up to now, man, they have been wildly successful. The stumbling is because of the panic hurry these warriors are in as they race to reinforce areas of the walls and the gates that are being attacked. Now, when the next verse speaks of "prepared is the covering," this is referring to the battering ram that the enemy has pulled up close to the city gates. Okay, the Hebrew word for the covering is sokek. In English, or Old English anyway, is called a mantelet. When a battering ram is used by the attackers, the defenders will stand on the walls above the gates and pour hot oil down on those using the battering ram, or they rain rocks and arrows on them. So a covering made of wood and tough animal hides is placed over the battering ram, like a roof, to help protect the soldiers. Therefore, this scene is of the enemy already in process of breaching the city gates before the city can set its defenses. The result is going to be a swift and bloody end and full submission of Nineveh into Babylon's hands. Nahum 2:7. The gates of the rivers are opened and the palace melts away. I prefer the way Young's literal translation puts it, "gates of the river have been opened and the palace is dissolved." See, dissolved is better than melts away because this speaks of something that happens due to water rather than of something that melts because of fire. Now, although I have mentioned this to a small degree in an earlier Nahum lesson, I'll take a bit longer quote from Diodorus Siculus, what he made about two decades before the birth of Yeshua. It corroborates what Nahum says will happen. He says, in the third year, a succession of heavy downpours swelled the Euphrates River, flooded part of the city, and cast down the wall to a length of 20 stadies. Thereupon, the king realized that the oracle had been fulfilled and that the river had manifestly declared war upon the city. Despairing of his fate, but resolved not to fall into the hands of his enemies, he prepared a gigantic pyre in the royal precincts and heaped up all of his gold and his silver and his kingly raiment as well upon it, shut up his concubines and eunuchs in the chamber he had made in the midst of the pyre, and burnt himself and the palace together with all of them.
Nice guy, huh?
Now, although indeed heavy downpours swelled the Euphrates River, it was the swelling of the nearby Tigris that overflowed into Nineveh. The person this is referring to is in most likelihood King Sin-shar-shun. Now understand, even though the biblical portrait is of a sudden attack and a swift victory for the invaders, swift is relative to the times. Invasions on well-defended walled cities took months, typically, sometimes years, since fighting could only take place in the dry and warm season. The picture the Bible paints about the fall of Nineveh, combined with the words of Diodorus Siculus, seems to indicate that the Babylonians assaulted the city, damaged it, but in the end, it was the flood that undermined nearly 2 miles of city walls along the Tigris River and allowing them in to sack the city. Now, whether the story of King Sin-shar-shun's demise is historically accurate or it's a legend, the amount of booty that Babylon and Media captured was enormous. Even if the king had tried to burn it up, therefore take it with him into the netherworld of the dead for a good, comfortable afterlife, that wouldn't have worked. The gold and silver would have remained even if it was now in cooled pools of melted silver and gold made so by the heat of the fire. Nahum 2:8. Its mistress is stripped and carried away. Her handmaids moan. They sound like doves as they beat their breasts. Here is the ultimate consequence of Assyria's actions. The people are captured and sent away, some in chains. The exile from their country that was their standing operating procedure on nations they overthrow, it's now their own fate. Here is another verse that no two Bible versions I've come across agree upon. So let's again look to a more literal translation and see what we can gain. In the YLT, and it is established, she hath removed, she hath been brought up, her handmaids are leading as the voice of doves, tabering on their hearts. So, the complete Jewish Bible is among a few versions that eliminates the first Hebrew words of this verse. The Hebrew word to begin it is hasub, which comes from a root word that means to take one's stand. While it is established, is good, a more concise English term would be determined. It is determined in the sense that a question or a situation has occurred requiring a response and a decision was made. The King James Version takes hasub to be a proper noun, a person's office or their personal name, which is not the case here. In truth, it was Jewish tradition found in the Targum that hasub was a person's name. The range of interpretations of this verse is long. W.A. Meyer, some 60 years ago, put together a list of 12 different translations. Most of them centered around the meaning of Husab. The reality is that this is one of those ancient biblical Hebrew words that is so obscure and rarely used that only speculation is possible. Although some speculations comport better with the overall context than others. So we're not going to do much better than to understand that this is all about the results of the Babylonian conquest over Assyria as meaning exile for many Assyrians. Okay, we'll pause here and resume with verse 8 next time.